Super excited to be on this awesome panel, and thank you all for the questions. I will, you know, I'll try to reference a couple of them, but I'm mostly going to talk about LA and both what we did and also some ideas and questions for the future. So just to contextualize it, the LA Unified School District is 82% Black and Brown students, 73% Latinx, and 8% Black students, and so that frames what we need to do as a union. And actually, our union is one of the few teachers unions in the country in which the teachers are about two-thirds teachers of color, 43% Latinx teachers, which has been steadily growing. And 10% Black teachers, which is in decline, as with many teacher unions around the country. Nationwide, 80% of teachers are white, so our union context is a little bit different. That being said, teachers of color have not always or much ever felt that our union program spoke to them, or that the way our union organized included them. And then I think that one of the things that we framed in terms of our strike and our contract fight was just to remind people that, like, racial justice and the underfunding of our schools are not separate things. So in California, the decline in school funding since the 1960s, when, you know, California public schools were considered the best in the nation, they were very well funded, has happened in tandem with the number of students of color in California growing. And we're now at 44th out of 50 states in school funding. So it's not a coincidence that the anti-tax policies and that let's divest from public schools happened at the same time as the number of students of color in those schools was growing. So there's a connection that we talked about in the lead up to our strike. And then just to also frame what racism in our schools looks like, and, you know, it means a lot of things to students, but some of the specific aspects in our school district, people may have heard about parents like Romulo Avelica Gonzalez, who was picked up by ICE as he was dropping his daughter off to school, and she tearfully, you know, video recorded that incident. And we ended up being part of a campaign that got him freed. But if schools would literally not taking into account what it means to have students coming to school from families that are in fear or maybe have somebody in detention. And then the issue of criminalizing searches of our students. Can you guys raise your hand if there's some type of searches or metal detectors at schools in your area? Oh, wow. Okay, so in LA, the policy looks like what are called random searches, which means every single day a school is required to go into classrooms and randomly pick out, okay, you, and you, come with me. Pull them out of their algebra class, you know, or their literature class, take them outside and wand them with a metal detector, and often ask them to dump out their bags and confiscate items. Most common items are like highlighters, hand sanitizer, you know, feminine products being taken from kids. And that's like, okay, go back into your class and think about learning, right? And the kids, like, in this, you know, very traumatic process, have to walk in front of their classmates and sit back down. This starts in the sixth grade in LAUSD, and no gun has been recovered in all of the years that this policy existed. Muslim girls report being searched and having their hijabs looked at and so forth. And so these are just some of the contexts that students experience in LA schools. So the question is, like, you know, how did our union begin to talk about and take these things on as a union? So the first thing I want to say is that it doesn't all happen within the union. Union contexts can be very overwhelming. There's so much you've got to do. There is a bureaucracy. There's like the contract to think about. And so in our context, student organizing and Black Lives Matter Los Angeles, the issues that they were raising were critical in pushing our union in the right direction. So one thing is obviously like your union organizing doesn't happen in a silo. You have to be engaged with anti-racist forces, you know, in your city. And students basically identified the issue of random searches early on as something they wanted to change. And they were organizing around it, going to school board meetings, distributing buttons to their fellow high school students before we took it up as a union. And that goes to someone's question about the tasing and so forth. I think that one of the things that helps to move conservative union or conservative colleagues is if you can get students to speak on their own behalf of what it feels like, and then you bring that to your colleagues a little bit as, so like, to whatever extent you can encourage students to write their stories and be like, this is what this feels like being criminalized when I'm supposed to be learning. That might be one vehicle to kind of help move colleagues. So that also being said, the vision of social justice unionism that our group Union Power that took office in 2014, we explicitly knew that there had to be an anti-racist element to what we were doing. Obviously, our context is part of it. But also understanding that that we were isolated as a union. We had no community allies because we had had such a narrow view of what we were doing and what our role was. And if we wanted to actually have a successful strike, we had to actually become thoroughly interconnected with the community. So I wanna say that I think Angela is gonna enlighten something that we didn't do, that we have a lot more work to do, which is someone else brought up, what about member education? So after the murder of Michael Brown, we formed a racial justice task force, and our first idea was, how do we get these conversations going in our school sites? Because the union had allied openly with Black Lives Matter, but we knew that like a lot of people, a lot of teachers didn't understand that or were having racist or hostile reactions. So we put together a set of readings about the school to prison pipeline and why we don't say all lives matter. And like just that kind of basic stuff that we felt, you know, a teacher that doesn't know anything about Black Lives Matter, like we need to talk to them. We had some of those conversations at schools. I think most schools didn't have those conversations, and that, you know, Angela's gonna talk about more of the education of teachers. The last thing I wanted to say is that even though Union Power had an anti-racist vision of unionism, when we took over the union and we started talking about our contract demands and how we have to include anti-racist demands, it was not like everybody agreed with that. So some of the debates, let's see, am I in the right place? So I just wanna, like, after Parkland, I've mentioned this in the other, after Parkland, right, there were people that were like, whoa, we gotta support school police and make schools safer. And so again, the voices of the students and having dialogue with student organizers who can just say, safety for who? This stuff makes me feel unsafe at school. And it was key for us to come back on that. Additionally, just some of the other stuff that was brought up, there's great research from the National Association of School Psychologists that says the more you criminalize students, the less they trust adults at your school, the less likely they are to go talk to somebody when they have a concern about safety or are afraid somebody else might be carrying a gun or whatever. So the more you criminalize, you set up this divide between the adults and the young people, that makes your school less safe. It's actually, so we had to really fight these things out, and there were people in our union, in the Valley, which is the whiter, more conservative part of LA, who held a pro-police rally after Parkland on behalf of the Valley area of UTLA. Now, that was the night before Black and brown students and Muslim students were holding a huge forum on ending random searches. Luckily, very few teachers showed up to the, there were a lot of school police there, but not that many teachers showed up to the pro-police rally. But this is bad. This is horrible, right? And we had to fight it out with those people. I think they lost in practice because they saw that the community supported us taking anti-race demand. Okay, I got like five more minutes, right? Okay, I gotta hurry up. Okay, second thing I wanna talk about is bargaining for the common good. And people probably know the idea behind it, which is that unions are often the most powerful organization in a community that exists. And we have a responsibility to use that power to get broader gains that go beyond just our own membership. And in schools, obviously, we also recognize that when students are facing such a range of oppression at home, you cannot disconnect that from what they're going through at school and the ability to succeed academically. So our contract demands ended up including a full package of community proposals that were developed with allied community organizations that included ending the random searches, included the creation of an immigrant justice fund that would actually support families facing deportation. Also included green space at every school, where the black and brown communities in LA have just a real dearth of green space, and school campuses are a place we could begin to address that. And we also called for the use of unused district space for affordable housing. Ethnic studies, I can speak about that in discussion if needed. It's a statewide graduation requirement now in California. The inclusion of this kind of program, there's a great article in The Atlantic about teachers of color in the strike, and there's a teacher, Rudy Duenas, who says, a sense of solidarity with their students is what's driving them to the picket lines, a profoundly personal connection to those children, and a fear that current school conditions are not serving them. He talks about growing up in the era of Proposition 187 that criminalized immigrants, and seeing a continuum from that to our strike. I just feel that's so important. The fact that teachers of color said, this is a continuation of an anti-racist struggle because of the way that we had framed the demands. Also because of that, we ended up having 82% community support of our strike because it was framed around the schools our students deserve and specifically around underserved communities. Around bargaining for the common good, just really quickly, all those great community demands, technically, we had to take them off the table to go to a strike. It's illegal to have non-mandatory subjects of bargaining on the table because you can't strike over them. We technically took them off the table. But the great thing is, once you're on strike, you can demand, you can throw anything you want back on the table as a condition of going back to work. I just want to bring that up because I didn't know that stuff before we went on strike, and they're going to tell you, you can't have those demands. They're outside the scope of bargaining. You can still get them if you go on strike for them. Okay, I have to wrap up, I just wanted to bring up some of the issues we're talking about moving forward. One is to say that our union has very few self-determined spaces for teachers of color, and that's something we gotta fix. If people know, the movement for Black Lives has a framework around invest and divest. And folks have brought that to us, and I found that to be a very useful framework. Not only what do we need to invest in, but what do we need to divest from in terms of criminalization. So we are talking about defunding school police as one of the next divest things that we gotta push for. And also, we got our union to sign on to something called Reform LA that's gonna be on the ballot in 2020. That takes money out of prisons and jails in California and puts it into housing, jobs, and education, and healthcare. So having our union take a position on something like that, that's beyond schools. And lastly, I think that we can, Patrice Cullors has a great article on abolition and reparations in the Harvard Law Review. that people should read. But I see schools as a locus of the fight for reparations. We're talking about where are the places where we can get resources into communities that have been systematically abandoned. And these are, this is one of the places where we can actually talk about doing that. But I'd be interested in what other people think about that. Thank you.
All right, so that was a good start to the conversation. I'm next going to introduce Tia Edison, who is a teacher in Kentucky. She's been teaching 12 years at middle school, which we were just joking is really like 24 years in middle school. She's part of Black Lives Matter at schools. She's the Black Caucus Chair and has been on the board of directors for her local union for 5 years. So give it up for Tia.
I was on the board of directors, but I chose to not be on there anymore.
Sorry.
okay. Because my union and myself did not see eye to eye.
I feel like this is
not staying up. Okay. So everyone has heard about Arizona, West Virginia, Oklahoma, all their strikes. In 2018, Kentucky did strike too. And it was over the teacher's pension. We had a governor and he wanted to, really they had been borrowing money from our pension for a long, long time. He came in and said he wasn't gonna pay it back, so we all decided to strike. It was a whole Kentucky 120 county strike. At the time, the one county that I live in is Louisville, Kentucky, which is the largest city urban district in Kentucky. And so in my district, we have 178 schools. We have 100,000 students. Over half of the students are black and brown children. 70% are free and reduced lunch. So that's the dynamics of my school or my district. So in that same year, there was a gang bill. I don't know if anyone's heard this story or not, but they were trying to pass, legislation was trying to pass a gang bill. And that same year, I had buried one of my students from a drive-by. So I am a member of Black Lives Matter, and so we were really pushing the state to say no to the gang bill, you know. And so as a teacher, I asked my union and the grassroots group that was calling for the strike if they would include just calling your legislator, saying no to the gang bill. Well, they said we were divisive. Mm-hmm. They started to kick us out of these groups. And I was sitting there like, what are you talking about? Like, this is our students that we're talking about, because the gang bill is a stop and frisk. If they see three to four students walking home from school, they can legally stop them and frisk them. So at that moment, there was a divisive relationship between Black Lives Matter and teachers, really. So they did the strike, and it was about the pensions, and we went on spring break, we came back. For some reason, they told us to go back to work, and we went back to work, and nothing really changed. The gang bill passed, and the following year, legislation came, and there were some issues that was now directly related to my district, Jefferson County. So they was getting ready to take away the site-based decision-making council, which is, I don't know if anybody knows what that is, but that is a decision-making body for the schools that is made up of parents and teachers and admins and everything that decide which principles and what policies and procedures are put in place for those schools. And so they was directly getting ready to take that away from only our district, no one else's district. At the same time, Well, we have a charter bill in 2016, but we do not have a charter school because we have really pushed back and there's no funding for it. So right now, Kentucky does not have not one charter.
Mm.
Yes.
Right.
And thankfully that we're so far behind that we can look at other cities and states and see how detrimental it is.
Right.
So that's what made us really, you know, push for this. So vouchers was on the legislation, and we already know, you know, what vouchers are going to do. Private school vouchers, they were going to take away money. You know, we've been having these privatizers come in and with Alec and the Koch brothers, and they're coming in with all this legislation, and we're just trying to stop. And it's really the parents. There's a Dear JCPS, there's a parent group that is really on top of it, Save Our Schools, it's another organization. These are not the union now. These are just parent and community organizations that have been awoke and watching what's going on in other districts and trying to keep us from being those other districts. So this year, we decided at in Jefferson County that we were not, since we had already, we knew what to do. We knew how to stick out. So when it came time, let me go. So the one group they called, because they were gonna change the pension board of directors for the state. Now, the union was upset about that. And so they went to their little grassroots people that had been calling for the strike, because they can't call for it because it's illegal. And so they told them to call for the strike. And so they called for the strike, and we did a strike. It was over the pension board of directors. So the very next day, they all went back to work. And Jefferson County, now the legislation was coming back for us, and they were coming to directly to get us. So what you haven't heard is that Jefferson County, we decided to stick out, and we closed school down. And we went up to Frankfort, and there was at least probably 3,000 to 5,000 teachers, and we stopped the vouchers. And we did this 6 times this year alone. While we were doing this, our union was calling us out. They were on the news, shaming the teachers. Our union president was. The governor has now subpoenaed all the names of the six. So he has my, I'm on a blacklist. he subpoenaed all the names of the teachers. So we had our superintendent, we had our union president, we had our governor. They were all on the news shaming us, but it was the rank and file that decided that we were gonna stick up for our kids and our district, and we were not gonna have it, and we just kept on, you know, calling out. So that's what's been going on, and you haven't heard about it because it wasn't sanctioned by our union. And what's happened, and I remember the first day that we was down there in Frankfort, I heard the union president say, oh, you're gonna ruin the rest of the relationship that we have with the state, and we don't have community support. Well, I have been a community organizer for 20 years. I know every social justice group in my city. I know every leader in my city. And they were having rallies, and I said, what are you doing? What are you talking about? The narrative is about to change. There is a parent rally happening tomorrow. There is this, that, and the third. We have, you know, the parents are setting up food camps and everything else. So what are you talking about? Like, and so, I mean, it just baffles me that we had to fight this fight, and we just, no one knows about it. And that's what Lois was saying, and Jillian was saying, like, where do we hear this from? And like, there's no story. It's not written down anywhere. I mean, besides our local news, you might see if you look it up. But yeah, so the governor, and I really do truly think that the union, the governor, the superintendent, everybody that was bashing us was working together to make sure that they, I mean, it was every time they were trying to come up with a scare tactic to stop us. And really the last one was the governor subpoenaed all of our names, and so a lot of the teachers got scared because they didn't know what he was gonna do. And we still don't know what he's gonna do. But that did, it kind of did work, like, because we wanted to strike in and there wasn't enough people to do it. So, I just wanted to put that out there. and it all kind of centers around the divisiveness that happened last year around the community support. Well, let's say, okay, let me go back. Because after we struck last year, the 2018, the state came back to our district and said they were going to do a state takeover. And so we were all nervous. Jefferson County, like, oh my goodness, we're going to get taken over by the state. And our union was like, we got to get community support. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I can help you with that, you know. So I pulled in some more Black Lives Matter organizers, and really, we told them to first admit that, because it was around all of the disproportionate suspensions, you know, all the things that is happening all over, really that's why we were getting taken over. And so we were like, you know, just announce to the community, yes, the district is not doing a good job. They haven't been that successful, but we're gonna work on it or whatever. And they said, no, this is about democratic, this is a democratic process, and that's all it is. And so really they pushed out, there was just so much arguing back and forth with the union leadership and the community organizers. They were not giving up their ego and their power, that was part of the problem. So at this point, we do not, the Black Lives Matter and the union does not have a good relationship at all. And when it comes to a state takeover, at this point, they're not gonna get community support because we're not getting ready to give you the support. Because you weren't there when we wanted you, you know, when we asked you to say no to the gang bill, you would not say no. So why should we, when we were trying to strike to keep the parent, the site-based decision-making council at the schools, you said, I mean, you were not for that. So actually our union gave it to the legislator to introduce it. Our union president did, and he didn't know that I found out, but I found out that he was the one that did that. So there's a lot of problems with corporate union leaders, and that was one of the reasons why I'm excited to be here, because I want to try to rally up my rank and file, because my rank and file in my district, they know. But it's just, I need to organize them, and I need the tools to really get them organized. And then once we get rid of, because my union president has been the president for 17, 18 years. So that doesn't make sense.
No.
So hopefully once I leave here with the tools that I need, I can organize my rank and file, and we can get him out of there, and then we can definitely build this relationship with the community, because the parents are behind you. When it comes to their students, like, if the teachers, we know what's best for our students. If you have a good heart, if you don't, you know, I know all of you do. So the parents and the community, we got your back, because we all were the best for our students. And I just encourage you to keep fighting for them, because you're gonna have these corporate union leaders, you're gonna have the Alec Koch brothers, the legislation coming left and right, and it's a struggle, and it's a fight. But there's more of us than there is them. So, mm-hmm. Okay. Solidarity. There's solidarity. Thank you.
Awesome. So I am very pleased to introduce our next speaker, Angela Crawford, who is from Philadelphia. Angela's been teaching for 23 years, another veteran teacher on this panel. Angela's part of the Working Educators Caucus in Philly, which some of you may also have heard of, that's doing some pretty badass work. And also is an organizer with Black Lives Matter Week in schools, which if you don't know about, you should know about after this meeting. So Angela.
Thank you, Daniel. Greetings, comrades. How are you?
All right.
Awesome. I'm honored to be here today, and I'm appreciative to organizers for inviting little me to come have a necessary conversation. So as Dana said, I am an educator 23 years, but I like to classify myself as a radical educator, just because you had to in the system. And it's just so necessary. So I wanted to start with a quote like I do often in my class, and it's a quote by Angela Davis, who's also the person that I'm named after.
Nice.
And the quote says, "When children attend schools that place a greater value on discipline and security than on knowledge and intellectual development, they are attending prep schools for prison." Mm-hmm. How many of our schools are looking like prisons?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I came into this field of education long time ago. I can't believe it's that long at this point. But I knew early on in my life that my innate purpose was to teach. I entered the field to culturally and socially educate students who looked like me. I knew from my own experiences that students needed an ally that would provide an education that would help students emancipate from the bondage of oppression that continuously demoralizes and divides Black students in this country. This emancipation would mean that I would control the narrative of the content and delivery instruction in my classroom in order to teach and promote critical thinking so students that I create relationships with can see the world behind and beneath the facet of a romanticized rhetoric and propaganda as a form of liberation. And I wanted to insert, because I know a couple of the questions was like, how do you do this work in your classroom? And most teachers are, most people in America have been trained to live in fear. And most of our school systems are very punitive, and you need to follow this. And I understand that we must eat and take care of our families and keep a roof over our head. So what do we do to combat the foolishness that is happening in schools to get rid of that? So in my classroom, when I said I'm a radical teacher and I just do the complete opposite of what people ask me to do. But, and what I mean by that is, so I teach English, and I teach English, decolonized English. So I have all African American students standing in front of me. So we're teaching English through African American experience. Because what our education system fails to realize is on basic fundamentals of child development. If you have children who you are not uplifting and empowering, how are they supposed to move forward and move up and feel good about who they are and walk this world with self-confidence? Well, that's not what happens with Black students. So if we think about when students hear about themselves, we hear about them in from slavery, right? As if slavery is the only thing that we're a part of in this country. And none of the other stuff, right? We don't hear about Nat Turner, we don't hear about anybody resisting against slavery, like we're just docile and passive people and we just let this happen, right, without a fight. So when we are teaching students not to value themselves, we get to train more zombies to feel like they're docile and passive, and we can push them along through, push them through school. You know, like we got pushed out of girls, we got pushed out of boys through prisons. We have all these things that exclude people. We have kids in cages. We have all of these things that does not basically fundamentally build children up. So we have to then take back our classrooms. So you figure out how you do that. So here's what you do. Mm-hmm. You got those standards you're supposed to have, right? So with them standards, and I know they tell you put this old, excuse my language, bullshit frameworks and stuff up, and they gotta say this and they gotta say that, and I don't have any of that. Right. So, and I'm really careful about language. So in Philadelphia, they use like your warm up supposed to be your do now, and I'm like, oh, that's such like this plantation prison mentality word. I'm not using that. Because I think that's really important that we teach our children to pay attention to coded language and what things mean. So, you know, I take that standard, okay, and it's really easy to do in English, and I really teach history, but in English. You gotta read something, right? So what happens is that I take the standard, and I say, well, this is what we're doing. And so this year, my 11th graders, who I will have, I'm following to 12th grade. Every quarter was a different thing, and we're reading books that, you know, when I gave them Asada, and I know most people are not going to read about Asada Shakur in nobody's school. In some places, like in New Jersey, I know it was censored and banned. But when I gave my students Asada to read, and I can tell you, many of my students have not read a book. Like, Miss, you want us to do too much. We haven't read a book since middle school, which is an atrocity of its own. But when they read Asada and came back, it's like, Miss, I'm finished the book. And I'm like, oh, well, we still got some time. I couldn't wait. Like, we're moving too slow, so I'm gonna read it over the weekend. And the amount of emotions that took place for her struggle and oppression and police brutality, they were angry. But they made parallels to what is currently happening today to Chavon, to Tamir, or to Sandra. They see those connections. They making connections by when they're walking down the street and they're late for school and the cop stops them to harass them and get their name and identification and address, like really walk into as they walk into school with a book bag and a school uniform on. So they making these parallels. So I have to change the instruction in the class because, you know, most of our kids are like, what do we need this for? Why are we doing this? This stuff is boring. How does this relate to my world, right? Those are always questions that you probably ask in school, right? I know I have, right? So to change that paradigm, we have to then make those connections with the uplifting and peace. So that's how I do it. I twist it, use objectives, people come in, and the class is engaged, and they thinking, and they're asking really good questions, great open-ended critical thinking questions. And the people, like, we do these walk-arounds, and they got the associate superintendent, and then they bring, like, a team of 9 or 10 people out of the classroom, and the kids is looking at you like, you know, whatever. And people are taking notes, and they taking notes. And what happens is nobody comes back to bother me. You know why? My students are engaged, and we're not doing standard, you know, 10.9 BC. We're just not doing it. I mean, it's there if you really need to see it, but kids don't care about that, right? Like, they just don't care. Like, teacher, who are you? Do you like me? Do you love me? Do you want to teach me? That's what they really care about. And are you teaching me something that's important to me?
Right.
So that's how I get around doing what I need to do and where nobody bothers me, right? And then the other piece to that is my classroom. My classroom is a sanctuary. It is, I teach from a very humanizing perspective. So the very first day of school, I had this conversation, and I'm very transparent about my kids. I don't give a hell about hoodies, because a hoodie doesn't determine if you can think. You know, you tell the kids they can't eat. Well, it's 8 o'clock in the morning, and you want me to do what? Miss, nobody's trying to do your work, because I'm hungry. And as a teacher, and as human beings, who in here is working when their stomach is growling? No, not one person, right? Exactly. So I don't know why we expect children to be able to do something that we can't do. So sometimes I have to like just tell my kids, like, in my room, I don't care about the hoodies. There's a sanctuary. The deans come in. Yo, take off that hoodie. I said, not in this classroom. It's their safe spaces, their sanctuary. Now, what you do in the hallway, I have no control over. In room 316, we're not bothering my kids about the hoodie. You know, I eat because I need you to be able to focus. Just throw your stuff in the trash because your mom and I here to clean up after you. So, you know, we got some boundaries, we have some rules, and we understand that. and understanding, you know, one of the things that I hate as a student, when people say, oh, you're a kid, you don't have any problems in the world. Well, have you seen what our kids have to do? They have problems, and they have problems sometimes more than I have problems, you know. And realizing that affects them inside the classroom. So why are we making school so isolated? And, you know, just alone last year that I can recall, the violence, the gun violence in our community is harmful, and it's damaging and traumatizing to our students. So when you say, well, what are your test scores? Where's your data wall? Like,
oh,
well,
shit, man.
How are we thinking about a data wall when he just seen his friend get shot? You know what I mean? Like, let's be real here. Like, that's the last thing. I don't give a hell about your test, lady, when I'm going through this. So I also have a space in my room where, like, y'all see I'm into crystals, right? So I have some crystals, and I got some, like, battery-operated candles and flowers, and kind of make a safe space with a little wicker basket. Like, they can put their names and hold the space for people that they lost or loved, just to honor them, because grief is real, right? So as everyone in this room has probably lost someone they love. And from time to time, like, you just don't get over it. At moments, sometimes it comes back and it clicks in your head, and you have that moment where it just kind of like gut punch you, and you need that moment. So I give my kids that space and time as well. So just humanizing the classroom allows that to also occur. And again, because my room is the sanctuary, people don't bother me because I can go in the hallway and tell kids stop doing something. And, you know, like, Ms. Crawford, we own the problems. And it's all good. So even kids I don't teach come in my room, because people tell them, oh, well, it's safe to come in her room. And I'm like, I don't know why you people are all here, but they're like all here. Like, I'm like, can I have some space? But it really is all good for that. But I also wanted to just now connect this teaching piece from what I do to just going into a little deeper here. So historically, the education of Black and Brown and Indigenous people had been racialized. We are aware that movements to make education equitable through various strategies, regardless of the numerous ways to make education the great equalizer, we have not reached the apex of the proverbial mountaintop. It will take a revolution of collective action and alliance with parents, communities on multiple levels. The collective action and reflection of people of our national and global landscape in order to transform the world. Our schools that serve our students are microcosms of the society in which we live. And I think, like, roughly Nelson Mandela, I'm chopping up the quote, but he says something about, you could tell about a society by the way they treat their children. So what does that say about us, right? In our school, when we look at our kids in our school. Yep. So in Philadelphia, the Caucus of Working Educators, I'm gonna just shout out, got some comrades over here that came out, in which I'm a proud member. We are an organization of teachers, paraprofessionals, and other school staffs collectively fighting for the principles of social and racial justice. We recently rolled out and provided anti-racist, anti-bias training to our members like 2 weeks ago. So the Racial Justice Committee developed a 20-hour, 4-day anti-racist, anti-bias curriculum that is in-depth, reflective, and helps dismantle white supremacy and see the humanity in Black and Brown students. So we feel like educators must transform their union based on principles that dismantle any and all structures that uphold white supremacy, capitalism, and patriarchy. So educators must connect the fight of education with the broader labor movements and social movements trying to confront the evils of the racialized world that is exploiting, raping, and killing humanity. So in Philly, we're fighting the power of our rank and file leadership. The current leadership is passive, docile, and useful. To be quite frank, when T was talking about her union president, I think they're twins, so they must be cloned from the same cloth. Because he's been around, I'm teaching 23 years, he's been around for about 21 years as a union leadership. Who, by the way, when we were trying to have our union endorse Black Lives Matter Week at school, which they did not support, but he told us that of course he supports black people because he's black. And that was the answer in a general membership meeting, which means nothing. Clearly it means nothing. So I say all that to say that they are also contributors of the problems that we see in our school. And I'm also going to add, because the caucus is doing so much great work, and I think Jillian brought it up the other day in another session regarding like the campaign around healing our schools and school conditions that we did in Philly. We do the work, and then they try to take the credit, right? So that's kind of what they do. They steal. But yeah, they do a lot of stealing. So there's going to be an election early 2020, and we are looking to do what Baltimore has done, take power. So we're looking to take power from the neoliberal puppets of our union and give it back to the people in which it's supposed to serve, the students, the teachers, school staff, and the community at large. So rank and file involvement means that teachers need to use their union as a weapon for justice at every school. And a part of that, I think what Jillian and Tia both had already iterated, is that without community, without parents, this is impossible to do. Because one of the problems that I think I've had some conversations in the last couple of days, and like how do you get educators of color to join the union or get become more involved and to participate. And you first of all, if it's not, and I came into teaching like old school style, right? I came into teaching when there were teachers who were teaching there for like 20, 30 years in the building, right? And now there's so many schools where the most senior teacher is like 5 years. And that's completely different from, you know, how I started in. But for those teachers who've been teaching as long as I have, and we come into teaching for the very same exact reason. If we're not talking about kids, and you're not talking about the issues and the injustices mm-hmm. that involve our kids, that's our fight. That's where you connect with us at. That's where you connect with the parents at. Because we all know that unions, especially business unionism, has a bad taste in everybody's mouth. Because we're just thinking about like just teachers. And yes, we are important, but why are teachers here? For kids, right? So that conversation is not about kids and about parents and community and building this alliance. Then like older teachers like me are like, yeah, I'm not, you know, we've been doing these politicians and we've been doing this and we know they're all in bed with each other and nothing's going to happen. And if we think that it even smells like business unionism as it looks right now, we don't want a part of it. And that's kind of the reason how I came to the caucus is because they were about action. And I'm not, excuse me, God bless you. I am a person who believes that you should walk your talk. And if you're not walking your talk, then as the kids say, miss me with that, miss me with it, because there's really nothing else to talk about at that point. So I'm just going to close with James Baldwin. So the future of the Negro in this country is precisely as bright or as dark as the future of this country. It is up to all of us whether or not we will face the belly of the beast or turn our backs. It is time to embrace the malaligned and maladjusted who have been marginalized and demoralized so long in this country. Let us use liberation as a tool for education and not bondage and for manipulation. So shine a light, comrades, shine a light. Thank you.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Angela. Thank you all the speakers so far. I'm gonna bring up Lois Weiner to close us out here from the panel, and then we'll have some time for discussion from the floor. How many of you are familiar with this book? This is another book that if you are not familiar with or something you're not familiar with out of this meeting, hopefully go check it out. The Future of Our Schools, Lois Weiner wrote this in 2012. She's like a teacher union whisperer. It really is like a handbook for how to do some of this work. So if you are a social justice educator and you're trying to turn your union into an anti-racist fighting machine, there's some really important lessons in this book and some how-tos for how to make that project possible. I know we used this, we read this together in Berkeley Federation of Teachers on our organizing team. It really helped shape our work. So I'm really, really proud to bring up Lois Weiner to close out this amazing panel and keep the conversation going. So, Lois.
So I want to first thank Dana for doing the legwork and organizing this panel, Haymarket and DSA and the Jacobin for hosting the conference. I want to add that I'm on the editorial board of New Politics, and that is where my work most often appears first. Lengthier work, although I do write for the Jacobin and in these times. The other people on this panel are doing the heavy work. They're doing the heavy lifting. The work that I do is made possible by their work and by your work. And the work that I do is thinking and theorizing based on what I know from helping and from observing. And so today, what I want to do is I want to set out what I hope will be some helpful theoretical ideas about this project of making the unions and making the U.S. labor movement what it has to be. So my commitment to that project, it's a conference of socialism, and my commitment to that project comes from my commitment to socialism from below, which signifies to me the creation of a society that encourages the emancipation of all humanity, the full emancipation of all humanity, a condition not possible under capitalism as it has developed. Forms of social oppression, racism, sexism, heteronormativity, xenophobia, are too embedded to extract from capitalism. The capitalist social, economic, and political order has to be toppled and replaced.
All right.
That's the starting point. Now, the way that racism relates to this for teachers' unions, because when we talk about a union, we also always have to look at the sector. You can't talk about steel workers without looking at the steel industry. You can't look about teachers' work without looking at the education sector. And what do we know about the education and sector? The education sector and racism? We know that we have two intertwined problems. One is the historic complicity of teachers' unions in countenancing conditions of racial inequality in public education. Teachers' unions did not create those conditions, but they countenance them. And we have to put that on the table to our members, and we have to acknowledge that honestly to communities of color. Right? That's the first thing. The second thing is, the other problem we face is a pretty sordid history of the U.S. labor movement in abetting racism in hiring, housing, and union membership. Now, this idea that a rising tide raises all boats is true. Class-wide demands do that. The labor movement has succeeded in doing that. It is also true that when a boat carries more baggage, when it's heavier, when it's weighted down, a rising tide doesn't automatically raise it as much as the other boats. And that is the role of racism in American society and in the American working class. Racial inequality is an inescapable factor in the work of teachers and teachers' unions, yes, even those who work in schools and states that are white. And if people don't understand that, we really need to unpack that. The cataclysmic collisions between teachers' unions and the African American communities in the 60s and 70s should be uppermost in our mind this moment in time, as teacher unionism is experiencing a resurgence. And Tia's example, I think, is very, very important for us to understand. Racism can be extraordinarily divisive in every teacher union strike that occurs in a city that has any significant number of minority kids. We should understand that. Moreover, neoliberalism has fused the rhetoric about its ostensible aims of ending inequality in education Two, it's attack on teachers' unions. Why have they done that? Why has the attack on teachers' unions been accompanied by the neoliberal reforms? You know why? In part because our enemies understand better than we do the power of teachers' unions, and also because racial inequality is teacher unionism's Achilles heel. Why is it our Achilles heel? For that, I want to turn to the work of Ted Allen, in particular, Jeffrey Perry's really smart analysis of Allen's work. I want to encourage people to read that. Perry wrote this article in 2010 in Cultural Logic. And one of the things I didn't know about white privilege and Ted Allen is that Ted Allen had been a member of the Communist Party. He left, I assume for good reasons. And Allen remained a Marxist and a union activist his entire life. But Allen argued against the use of his idea of white privilege in this way. He said, first of all, you're missing the fact that racism is a function of capitalist social control. It's a mechanism that capitalism uses to maintain control. And racism is not innate in the working class. White supremacy is not innate. It is taught and it is learned. And those two facts are very important for us who have an anti-capitalist perspective. And I want to say that the very often we see class-wide demands counterposed to talking about racism. And I want to say why that's so dangerous. That idea that class-wide demands should be prioritized, which I've read in work by socialists. I want to talk why that is so dangerous. First of all, it's dangerous because I want you to ask Tia and Angela how parents and students and teachers of color hear class-wide demand should be prioritized. I know how they hear it. They hear it as you wait. You wait for the white working class to be ready to deal with racism, which is exactly what happened in Kentucky. And it is a disgrace that the story of Kentucky, the real story of Kentucky, in regard to racism, has not been told. That's what I want to say. And it should be corrected ASAP. Because when we don't raise race proactively, it divides. It divides and it hurts us. So the challenge then, understanding that I hope you know that a quarter of the members of the AFT voted for Trump and a third of the NEA members voted for Trump. Do you know that? Mm. And you talk to students of color, you talk to parents of color, and you hear all the time about experiences they have had with teachers who they have found racist. Mm-hmm. It breaks my heart. And they view teachers' unions as protecting racist teachers. Mm-hmm. We have to put that on the table.
It's true. Yeah.
We have to put that on the table, yeah, as something that we grapple with. You know, that's the reality. Doesn't mean the teachers are racist. There are all kinds of conditions in the schools that cause people to act in ways that harm kids. Of course, racism is a factor, unexamined racism. But we have to acknowledge that reality. For millions of children of color. We have to acknowledge that. As socialists, we have to acknowledge that. So I want to suggest that the challenge, and the other thing I want to say is one of the questions that people asked was, how do we talk about racism? How do I talk about that to new teachers? And what I want to say is I have so much to say about that I could write a book. So I did. It's called Urban Teaching the Essentials. And one of the, I'm actually known outside socialism and teachers unions most for my work on urban teacher education, because I talk explicitly about dealing with racism in schools and teachers who are racist and conditions that make you see kids as the enemy. So I recommend that to you if you haven't, if that's something you want to pursue more. But this conference is supposed to be about teachers unions and, I mean, the session and anti-racism work. And so I want to go to what I think the challenge that we face is. And it's a challenge, I think, that CORE and the Caucus of Working Educators have done extraordinarily well. And I think what they have done really well is to embed teachers' economic and professional interests in a program that is not only broad, but explicitly anti-racist. Broadness is not good enough. It has to be explicitly anti-racist, because the people who are our best, most natural allies are parents and teachers of color in cities, and cities have always been, have, with the exception of West Virginia, which is 96.4% white and rural, every other state is marked by having cities in which teachers' unions are the most developed. And that is the reason strategically that racism is so important for teachers' unions, because of the role of cities and because of so-called minority populations inside them. So I want to suggest that if we understand this process not just as broadening the agenda, but as embedding working conditions and professional interests in a program that is explicitly anti-racist, what we do then when we organize is we actually do something that every good union organizer knows. Every good organizer knows. Every good teacher knows. You take people from where they are. You take the things that they are willing to fight on, and you explain to them how winning those demands is going to require reaching out to people who should be our allies. But to have an ally, you have to be an ally, right? Important lesson for the labor movement. To have an ally, you have to be an ally. And that means if we want allies of communities of color, we have to be an ally. We have to be an ally, we have to show up for them, and we have to make that explicit. So Diane Goodman's anti-racism work is very useful. She does anti-racism work. She's very useful in understanding what I would describe, she doesn't, as liberal methods of anti-racism work, appealing to empathy, moral and spiritual. But what Goodman does that's very interesting is she argues against the commonly held negative connotation of self-interest. You know, that's considered bad to be self-interested. But she says, if you define self-interest as being individualistic, and it means that you gain at another person's expense, right? But if it's defined as something that's short-sighted and concerned with immediate benefits, then it can be construed as being negative. And that's always the complaint that's made against teachers' unions, right? Teachers' unions are selfish. They only work on behalf of teachers' interests, economic interests. But Goodman says, if you have a more relational view of self-interest, seeing actions as being mutually beneficial, work on behalf of others is simultaneously work on behalf of oneself, since our lives and our fates are intertwined. In other words, we cannot separate our fate as teachers from the fate of our students and the communities they serve. It is in our self-interest, therefore, to make sure that we fight in ways that show that mutuality of purpose. It's the only way we're going to win the kind of gains that we need. I don't think we could find a better definition than Diane Goodman's of the mutuality of self-interest than that of labor's key principle, solidarity. That's what fighting against racism means. It is the definition of solidarity in a racist society where racism is used to divide the working class. That is the meaning of solidarity. And I think that it's important, therefore, when we confront this rhetoric about class-based demands, right? That we need to prioritize class-based demands, that we interrogate that, and that we understand that solidarity of the class, depends on the class fighting for itself, for the entire class. Isn't that right? So I want to end with a comment on the caucus. And I'm doing a lot of work now in rethinking the caucus. Because of what's happened in the last, the great things that have happened in the last 8 years. So I think what the caucus does, the caucus creates a democratic space within the union, a democratic space within the union to duke out these issues. It's a place for social justice teachers, for people who are committed to anti-racism work, to duke out these ideas, work out the formulations, and then fight within the union for it. But our ability to really win over the majority of teachers to an anti-racist social justice program, I think means democratizing the unions so that they feel their self-interest is represented by the union in a way that is progressive. Thank you.